I think there's an understanding in the United States, Mexico, and Canada that the final termination of native people is going to occur. Krikche now sees his opportunity, and he's in the final stages of being prime minister, to really push the white paper through.
Introducing a four-part series on CKUT 90.3. Legislation will be presented, potentially changing Canada's relationship with Native North America forever. Tune into this station for long-term memory radio. A four-part series on Canada's relationship with Native North America every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m.
The liberation of Native North America becomes priority number one for anyone serious about ultimately winning the struggle at hand.
CKUT, long-term memory radio.
In 1884, the federal government of Canada asserted that they aimed to, quote, make Indians white men in the eyes of the law, end quote. Fast forward to 2002, and some would say that little has changed. The current federal government will be seeking to replace the Indian Act with the First Nations Governance Act and the First Nations Financial Institutional Act. While the Canadian government is seeking final solutions to unresolved Aboriginal treaties and other issues, the lack of consultation with natives and the focus on passing federal legislation leave some asking, are First Nations ready for the drastic redefinition of their rights and powers as this country's original peoples and owners? This four-part series of the Long-Term Memory Radio Project is dedicated to discussing the issues around the federal government's latest attempt to redefine its, and subsequently the Canadian people's, relationship with our Aboriginal neighbors. Part 1 will bring the Indian Act and the current legislation into focus. Part 2 includes a discussion about Native resistance movements and the media's systematically poor coverage of Native issues. Part 3 is dedicated to understanding how the Canadian government's policies have impacted Aboriginal women. And Part 4 will be produced by youth from Montreal's Native Friendship Center. Stay tuned for long-term memory radio on this station. On the line with us, we have two wonderful women activists, and they've actually joined us to speak about how the Indian Act has impacted Aboriginal women, this being a very important topic at this time as the First Nations Governance Act seeks to somewhat replace the Indian Act, a legislation that has been in effect and somewhat had extreme control and repercussions for women, specifically First Nations women, since 1874. So by way of introduction, we've asked Michelle Audette to introduce Denise David, and Denise will do the same for Michelle. So Michelle?
Okay, Quakers. No, I have the privilege to introduce you a strong woman, but I'm sure she's sensitive also. What I know from when I see her, I know she never takes a no for a no. And she believes in nationhood and doesn't believe in the Indian Act. So we agree on that. And this is Denise David.
Thank you, Michelle. And Michelle, that is, she's going to be heading a new generation of activist women fighting for their rights. She's president of the Quebec Native Women. And I've had the privilege of watching her in action in many different forums. And Michelle is, like I said, she's heading a new form of activism of the younger people. And they'll learn a lot from watching her. It's Michelle Audette.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much for committing the time to speak with us about this issue of the First Nations Governance Act, and hopefully we'll get to the kinds of resistance that's happening today around this issue of the First Nations Governance Act. But I wonder if we can trace back for our listeners to this, the sort of origins of the ideas of the idea of legislating our relationship with other people living around our communities, particularly First Nation. In 1874, the federal government sought to control membership and the style of government. They even went as far to implement residential schools within Native communities. And one of the things that we want to consider within
understanding the First Nations Governance Act and this piece of legislation that's now before the government, and what attempts are being made to reorganize our relationship with our Native neighbors, is to understand what the impact has been over the years of Canadian Indian policy in general. And as far as I can tell by looking at the books, it kind of goes back to 1874 with the Indian Act. And I'd like to invite Denise, maybe you can provide your own assessment of that. Where does Canadian Indian policy begin for you, and particularly how has the Indian Act over the years shaped the community that you come from?
Where does it begin? I think it begins a long time ago, which is, like you said, the 1874. I mean, we had most Native nations had their own traditional governments, and they were following the mother for clans and everything else, their title holders of the land. And that was a policy that was enacted in order to take away and try and abolish our Native nations by taking away the rights of the women in that sense. And so doing so, it also started attacking our language, our culture, our ceremonies, because they were taking rights away from the women. So they started attacking our governments a long time ago because they saw how good the system was set in place. I mean, it's so good the U.S. have copied our system under the Six Nation Traditional Iroquois Confederacy. I don't know if Michelle has anything to add.
For other nation where the women didn't have a role like Denise Nation, what I can remember, not that I was there, but you know, my mom was telling me stories, and my grandmother or other people, that we used to have control of our lives, and that includes everything, the land, the nature, the culture, tradition, values, and all that. Plus, we had the respect between men and women. And, of course, when the Europeans arrived, we lost all that. And what they did before the Indian Act, they wanted to make sure that we become good citizens, because for them we were savages. The way I understand the history coming from my people, they want us to become a farmer, you know, with a farm and pigs and cow. But for the Innu nation, that they travel all the time following the animals, it was hard for them to stay put still there and, you know, look the caribou walking by. So it didn't work, and it didn't work across Canada. So that's where in 1869 they decided to impose to us the legislation known today as the Indian Act. But it wasn't the name. It was the Act for the Emancipation, Assimilation for Savages. So it was just the name. It was telling that we will become good citizen. You know, Canadian citizen. But after that, they changed the Indian Act, and what they did way at the beginning, it was affecting the women, of course. I agree with Denise, but it was also affecting the entire ways of life that we used to have, because they put on us the concept of civil disability, principle of guardianship, with the also with the Indian registry. We have today, when I'm talking to you, we have probably 12 kind of Indian, according to the Indian Act, you know, which I think it's really discriminatory and racist. And, of course, the later we had the residential schools that it was imposed to us. So it was really affecting us. And it's still today. We have the impact of the Indian Act. We can see now that we're, because of that, suffering.
Denise, I wonder if you can add to this and sort of expand out the kinds of impacts that the Indian Act legislation and Canadian Indian policy has had on communities that you have worked with over the years. Michelle has just mentioned that there's 12 kinds of Indians underneath the Indian Act that is specifically referring to membership issues. There was also the band council system that was brought into effect under the Indian Act, something that specifically impacted women's roles in your community. You sort of touched on that. I wonder if you can expand upon that a bit more for our listeners. Talk specifically about the impact of this legislation on women's traditions.
Well, the impact that it has, I mean, right now, I mean, okay, like, I do not recognize the band council system because I feel that it's just an arm of the government, the federal government. It's just another envelope under the federal government. The legislation of the Indian Act had formulated these band councils and set them into place and power. They more or less follow the guidelines of the Indian Act, the Indian legislation. You know, that's what they are there for. Whereas the traditional governments, there are the checks and balances. You have the women's roles, you have the men's roles, and you also have the children. We all have a role. And the way it's impacted into our communities is the loss of identity, the loss of culture, the loss of language, and they don't know their roles anymore. There is no checks and balances. I mean, the men have been put into power through Indian Act systems, and they are the ultimate power. I mean, they oversee a lot of programs and everything else that affect the women. And if a woman needs to have housing, I mean, you have to go through this whole system. And those who are under C-31, I mean, again, have been affected. I mean, we have a lot of non-Native women who have more status than Native women. Even when they were brought back and supposedly given status, you know, they were brought back under some, you know, the legislation has not been equal. Put it that way.
Well, it sounds like in 1869, at least from what Michelle had said, that the goal had been assimilation right from the get-go in terms of Canadian Indian policy. And you're describing that essentially that goal has been effective. It's been successful. And there have been extreme losses due to that. Do you feel like the Canadian government is recognizing what the real cost of assimilation has been for the First Nation neighbors in this area in Canada?
I think I would use a different term. I would say genocide. To me, the Indian Act was a policy, a genocide policy against Native people. You know, and the impact is very severe. I mean, through the residential schools, through the other different acts that have been put under, you know, they are accomplishing, but they'll never have complete, you know, they will not have complete assimilation of Native people. Because even if there's one person in every nation that still stands out and holds out and keeps their language, keeps their culture, their tradition, their ceremonies, they have not accomplished what they've set out to do. And they can try and take away our rights and numbers, but it doesn't mean they're going to take away who we are as a people. You know, they can, like they've given each band member a number. They can give me a number all they want. I'll tattoo it on my forehead, on my arm. I don't care. I have a name, and I belong to a nation, and I have rights, and I have ceremonies, I have traditions, and they can't take that away. But they are taking it away from some people who don't know their rights, and that's the difference.
One of the issues that we're also hoping to get to is to talk about resistance to Canadian Indian policy over the years. And Michelle, I know you're working very hard on resisting the First Nations Governance Act today, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But Denise, I wonder if you could specifically speak to how women have resisted the Indian Act over the years. You talk about the band council system, and you mentioned the traditional government. Obviously, just the survival of that traditional form of government while it was outlawed by the Indian Act legislation is in itself a form of resistance, but maybe you can describe other types of resistance that have taken place over the years and some of the successes made by women protesting this legislation.
There, oh my goodness, I mean, just with the Quebec Native women, how they started out, I mean, Michelle would know more of that history, but how they took up and marched. Michelle, maybe you can jump in here, because I remember joining them when they came through my community.
Mm-hmm.
And both my parents are Native. But I had community members asking, how come I'm marching with these women when I have my status? And you march with someone who I've always been taught by my parents. You march with someone who has their rights taken away. You help them. You walk with them. And that's what I did. And maybe Michelle can talk more about that march.
Well, maybe for the people who's listening this interview, when they imposed to us the Indian Act, now it's known now by Indian Act, the new name, the women were the first one really affected by the Indian Act. And just to give you a brief history, how we were affected, and still today, when a woman was marrying a non-native, she was automatically expelled, you know, from her community. So she lost the right to speak her language, to stay and, you know, live in her community and with her own people. But on the other side, when a non-native was woman, of course, sorry, was a native, she gained full status. So you see that the children, you know, were becoming Indian, but not on the women's side. And we fought until 85. But before 85, we had few women across Canada who started to use the justice system to go in court. And one is Jeannette Lavelle Corbière. And she went in court and lost. And then we had Mary Tuax early from Ganawagi, who after her husband died in the United States, she decided to move back to her territory, which is Ganawagi. And the community said, no, you can't, because you're no longer member of Ganawagi, because you marry out, plus you were away more than 5 years from Canada, so you're not Mohawk anymore. So you won't be able to be buried in your own cemetery. So she couldn't believe, because in the same community, they had a dog cemetery, and her dog could be buried in her own territory. So she started to fight and speak loud and louder, and then women started to realize, gee, I'm not the only one. So they start to get together, and finally in 1980-something, they start to create that huge movement and walk and make a march here till Ottawa, until Ottawa, and that's where they went to Ganawagi, and I think it was in 83 or 84, I don't remember the exact date, and those days, women were really, really involved, because they had to fight, it's sad to say, to fight among their own brother and sisters or father from their own communities. And we had women like Denise, who's not affected by the Indian Act, I mean, with the status, because her parents are both Mohawk. But we needed women like Denise, and a lot of women started to get involved. And at the national level, we had the Métis Nation who started to get involved with us. The Inuit women, who's not affected by the Indian Act, started to get involved with us, plus the Canadian women. So it made a big change in 1985.
We're going to just take a brief break and come back and talk about the current issues mobilizing resistance against the First Nations Governance Act. We're speaking with Denise David and Michelle Odette, and we'll be right back with them.
Hey, when you're
So I want to move to the First Nations Governance Act, what the government of Canada is currently looking at this spring, and I suppose trying to make some sort of decision about before summer break. Michelle, you have been mounting a campaign on working with the Quebec Native Women's Association, and I wonder if you can tell us about current struggles that women are facing today, women are mobilizing today around the Indian Act and this new legislation, the First Nation Governance Act. You had just spoken about resistance to the Indian Act and spoke a lot about resistance mobilized by people's frustrations around membership issues. What are the issues with the First Nation Governance Act that are mobilizing people's resistance today?
Right now, under the Indian Act, without the Bill C-7, which is a governance act, the minister is known as, I don't believe it, but he's known as the father in trust for all Indians. So he's responsible for our land, our education, our money, our election, our wills, and members belonging to a banned list. And, of course, there is no recognition in our culture, our tradition, our language, and, of course, our ties to our territory. So we've been fighting for many, many decades denouncing all that. But badly, what it's worse right now under the Indian Act, what happened in 85, the women fought so hard that they finally gained something. Not the entire what they were hoping to get, but they only got half of it in 85. The Indian Act was amended, and we know that the name now, it's Bill C-31. So the women got back their status, but we had several example of discrimination based on gender, even after 85. And when the minister announced that a year and a half or almost 2 years ago, he said, well, I'm going to change the Indian Act, and I hope it's going to please everybody here because it's so paternalistic, it's so old, it's so, you know, we should change it. So, of course, Quebec Native Women was excited because finally we'll end it all discrimination based, you know, on gender under the Indian Act. But the minister, not him, but the people from his cabinet said, well, I'm sorry, Madame Odette, it's going to take too much time. All the membership issues, all the family violence issues, all the poverty, justice, whatever you've been claiming for so many years, it won't be part of the consultation because it's going to take too much time and it's going to cost too much to the Canadian government. We were really, really shocked. We couldn't believe. So we said to them, okay, you want to amend the Indian Act because you think that the communities are not enough transparent, which some I can agree that they need to be more transparent and accountable to their people, of course. But you want to change also the election rules, and you want to change the l'aspect juridique of the communities. But within 40 years, there will be no more Indian under the Indian Act, because the way it's set up right now, we will be enfranchised and assimilated. Like Denise said, it's a form of genocide. No more Indian. So who's going to vote for who? And even in Ganawagi, not far from here, they had a research done a few years ago. There are probably 8 or close to 9,000 Mohawk register there. Within 25 years, only 1,000 left. It's close. And in Ontario, we said to him, there's a community, there's only 2.5 years left for them to be registered under the Indian Act because they never set up a citizenship the way they recognize themselves, the way they register their people. Nobody did that exercise. I believe we used to have ways to recognize our people, but because of the brainwash of the Indian Act, after 130 years of, you know, that legislation imposed to us, some of us, they don't make a space or they don't want to have the tradition coming back. They're afraid. And some of them, they're ready. So we said to him, and to his cabinet and to his people, well, your governance act, I'm sorry, it's just another process to accelerate the assimilation of our people.
And Denise, you had described earlier that assimilation that Michelle is referring to, assimilation being the stated goal of the Canadian government in legislating relations with First Nations people in this country, that that assimilation was indeed genocide, not anything less. What are your thoughts on this piece of legislation?
I have mixed feelings about the legislation. I mean, well, the wording and stuff. I mean, like I said, I'm traditional. I have my own birth certificate, death certificate. We have our own marriage certificate. You know, we hold still those things. I don't have a Band Council Indian Act card to say that I'm Indian through the government. I have my own. I don't need I am entitled to some of those rights under the Indian Act, which it pays for my housing and my education and so on and so forth. I mean, that is due to me. I mean, my ancestors paid dearly with their lives for everything. This legislation, I think it's another form for the government. I mean, now they have to be held accountable for what they've spent on Native people. And they've never really took notice and were accountable to anyone with the monies that they spend on Native people. But they try and justify it whenever there's an uprising or as it's called in the media. You know, to make a big hype. They say that they spend X amount of dollars on one person is worth this much. But they've never really accounted and were accountable. And now someone is being accountable. They're making bank councils accountable, which is good. We have to be accountable to our people. But they have to show accountability, and they're forcing it through our people. Again, it's a forced legislation. So like I said, it's some parts of it is good and the other parts are not. I've not really read the whole thing because it should interest me more, but I just feel it's the third phase of the white paper policy, and this is the final phase.
Michelle, I wonder if you can comment on that. What has been the output of this and the extent of this consultation process that the Canadian government claims to have set up in trying to pass the First Nations Governance Act?
Well, first of all, I think, like Denise said, personally, without my Quebec Native women involvement, just me as a human being, I know that some band council, and even my band council, that they need to be accountable because the previous leadership, holy, I don't know what they did with the money, okay? And with this legislation, it's going to force them to be accountable to us, and which is good. But at the same time, the way the minister did his approach, for me, it was an approach. It was another way of imposing his mentality or paternalistic ways of "Bombay, I'll take care of you, dear Indians across Canada." And I didn't feel comfortable because he was telling me this is a partnership between Quebec Native Women and INAC, and I was like, "Partnership? Could you tell me what is the definition of partnership? Is it the dictionary definition, or it's the Canadian government definition?" And he couldn't understand. I said, "Well, usually partnership is nation to nation or equal. You know, we're equal, and you set up all the term of references. You decide on what you will consult our people and what you're gonna do for us. I don't feel that I'm a partner." And so we had to fight, and we fought so hard that at the end we said, "Well, go ahead with your consultation, but without Quebec Native Women." And the first thing we said to him also, it's, "Well, you're using the terminology of governance." And what we said to him and to everybody, "Well, governance for us means that it's something that it was going to help us to govern ourselves, not only something to push his legislation, because governing it means that we take care of our identity, our culture, our ways of life, etc., etc. And he's just telling the Canadian population how good he is with us, because we'll be more autonomous, is that what we say in English, with this piece of legislation, which I today I don't believe. And for me, the way he was doing also the consultation, he says, well, his government says that they consult 10,000 First Nation people across Canada. And each time I went to sneak, you know, just to look when they were doing their consultation here in Quebec, the room was always empty. In Quebec City, Val-d'Or, Montreal, the room was always empty. I said, where did he get his numbers? And they said to us, well, they did it by the internet, and they did some consultation here in Quebec where they had people. But they never asked the person, will you be affected by the Governance Act? Are you a registered Indian? You know, do you have a status? If not, well, you're not affected by the Indian Act. So they just had people. So we'll never know how many people really participate to that Indian Act. And if you read the media, the newspaper, on the radio also, all the hundreds of hours that they had to hear the groups and people across Canada not long ago, the Standing Committee on Aboriginal Affairs, few people said it's a good thing that the Governance Act is good. The rest, the majority, 99%, were just saying this is not self-government, this is not the right for self-determination. It's just another way to impose to us how we should do things in our communities, and it's just accelerating, like I said before, to make sure that we're enfranchised or assimilated. So for me, poor him, he didn't do it. He had good intention, but he should have put the major organization, the people at the grassroots level, like Quebec Native Women, also sit at the table and say, where should we change the Indian Act for now, just for a transition period until we go for a treaty or a self-government agreement.
We're speaking with Michelle Audette, who is with the Quebec Native Women's Association, and we're actually going to come back after a brief break and talk about what any type of legislation should look like, what you would hope to see included in it, Michelle. And also Denise David is on the line with us too. And we don't have to necessarily discuss legislation when we come back. We'll speak generally about the processes you would hope the Canadian government could move towards engaging with First Nations people in this country. We'll come back right after this brief break.
I shake, I shout from time to time. No attention is paid to mine. I feel for you, not just for me. My heart beats on. Why can't you see? Don't steal my thunder, don't break my heart. I'm your mother, hear my beating heart, hear my beating heart. Rape the land, rape your mother, take the poison. All my waters, cut the trees down to my soul, strip my body of all its oil. Don't steal my thunder, don't break my heart. hear my beating heart, hear my beating heart. Don't steal my thunder, don't break my heart. I'm your mother, hear my beating heart, hear my beating heart.
On the line with us we have Denise David, Michelle Odette, and we're just winding down a discussion about a piece of legislation that is in process right now. The Canadian government has for quite a while been trying to organize and reorganize its relationship with First Nations people in this country, the ramifications of which for women we've been discussing in the last half hour, and hopefully some of what could be done by non-Native people we can get to in just a bit. But just to ask both Michelle and Denise, what are your thoughts on what process the Canadian government should be engaging to address the issues that you raise are definitely problematic under the Indian Act as it stands, the band councils, the experience of the residential schools, and these membership issues? What process should the Canadian government be seeking to establish to either rectify or just to even change the way it has organized the way we relate to First Nations people in this country?
You know, a lot of Native nations and communities have had their own, like I said, the traditional people, we've had our own membership in place and everything. But nothing will work if they leave out the main component, unless what they're trying to legislate is, like I said, the final phase of the white paper policy and the genocide. If that is what their true goal is to wipe out the Native people, then why hide it through all these different titles of First Nation Governance Act? I mean, they're using these titles, and the Native people are not part of that system. They're not part of the process. They don't have a say. And what they should be doing, that's not First Nations Governance Act. That's what it is. It's the white paper policy. It's the white legislation. It's nothing more. And the Native people have to have a say. They have to put in what they want, not vice versa. That's my opinion.
And Michelle?
Well, for me, I would say to the government and the people, I would say, well, the Canadian government, first of all, needs to respect the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People, the RCAP that was done a few years ago, and there's good recommendation, so they should respect that. And, of course, I would say the most important right now, they need to repair all form of discrimination against women and their children under the Indian Act. It's an emergency for me and for the organization that I work for. And, of course, we need to have a transition period for self-government. So if they change the Indian Act, to accelerate the self-government or their treaty process. Yes, it's good, but at the same time, we need tools at the community level to educate our people, to prepare them for that, because, like I said before, 130 years of oppression, I guess we say in English, really affect our people. And I would say it would be good that the government help the Quebec Native Women, the university, or other organization across Canada to promote self-esteem, to have workshop on empowerment, and also to learn about who we were a long time ago, because some of us lost, you know, the past.
Well, talking about responses to the First Nations Governance Act, there hasn't been any sort of information given to non-Native people about this legislation. It's primarily a conversation between the government and some First Nations peoples, those who have participated in the consultations by whatever means, and groups like yourself who are trying to shape and inform the government of the process that they're engaging. Michelle, what do you think the process should be for non-Natives in responding to the government's attempt to redefine relationships with First Nations here in Canada?
Well, if I was a Canadian citizen, a man or a woman, I would say, dear government, it's about time that you change the history in our school, because what I've learned from our people here, from the people of this land, they were savages and they were killing people. And not long ago, high school and college, that's what I learned about my own people. So I think I would say that to the provincial government and the federal government, change the history in the schools, because we will be the one who will take your place, and we will have to negotiate with the First Nation people here across Canada. But we need to be prepared and more sensitive about their needs, realities, and who they are. I would say that's my dream as a Innu woman, that we change the history, and that we are the one telling what we did and what we do today.
And Denise, your thoughts on the response of non-Natives?
I think in order to make changes at the top, we have to make changes within ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true what Michelle says, we have to change the history, but we also have to change in how we get along with each other. There has to be that respect. We have to learn about other people's cultures. And just with the Native people, just in Quebec, I mean, you're talking 13 different nations. And we all have different histories. Well, we have similar histories, and yet they're different. So we're not, you can talk about Native people, but there's so many of us. And it's just like individuality. We can't say that one group is all the same. It's impossible. And it's to get to know the individuals first and get to know each other on a respectful level and start creating a balance and the compassion for each other, because it's not just in Native communities that I see the violence. It's all over, and we have to change it. And that starts with ourselves and the respect. And in order, if we start respecting ourselves and at the lower level, hopefully it will get to the top, whether it's Bank Council, whether it's even in traditional government or your government, the federal or provincial. It has to change.
And Denise, what's your thought on the shape and the look of that relationship once that change is brought? What would that relationship feel like between First Nations people and Canadians?
When I tell my grandchildren, and what was told to me, is we have to know who we are first, and we also have to know who, what laws are out there and who we come in contact with. So a little bit of the historical backgrounds of different people, and that's how we get that world view. I don't know, that's a hard question to answer, really.
Yeah, it's envisioning, but also trying to express it on the radio too.
Mm-hmm.
So it does get a bit tricky, but Michelle, I don't know if you have anything to add to there, because I do want to sort of paint a picture of the timeline.
Okay.
for this legislation. Do you want to respond or add anything to Denise's words there?
Well, I'll do my best in English. I never said that in English, so you'll be the first one to hear that in my super English. Well, yeah. For me, when we let a children growing in the ignorance, it's hard for him or for her to understand who's beside him, like another culture or another way to do things. So by putting a stop to that ignorance, I think we will find that balance, like Denise said so well. And we need that balance, because if they understand where we're coming from, what our realities and our struggle today and our vision for the future, and they can understand also they'll be part of that vision and part of that balance, I don't think they'll be frightened when we'll say we want to sign a treaty for self-government and we will share this land with you and our people. But because they don't know who we are and they just hear bad stuff about us, it's totally normal that they react when we claim something that we never give away, by the way.
Well, I do want to thank you, Michelle, for taking the opportunity to join us, and Denise, you as well. But before we let you both go, the reason why we had originally invited you to participate in this conversation was the First Nations Governance Act. And obviously, this legislation calls up so many different issues. We could spend hours talking, but just because of a lack of time and very busy schedules, I hope that everyone goes back to get involved in resisting this FNGA, the First Nations Governance Act legislation. But just in terms of a timeline for this legislation, Michelle, can you sort of tell us where it's at now and where it's going, and maybe even inform us as to who should be called and informed as to opinions of this attempt by Canada to renegotiate relationships with First Nations communities?
Okay, the standing committee just finished the session that they held across Canada. Now they're at the stage of putting a report recommendation from all the those sessions, and hopefully from that report it will be like no governance act. Let's cross our fingers, and that's the stage right now. But if individual people or groups wants to support the First Nation movement against the Indian Act, they can always give us a call or send us a letter or an email at Quebec Native Women, at the Assembly of First Nation in Ottawa or in Quebec, and from there we can get all the support from there and send it to the appropriate person in Ottawa, which is Bloc Québécois and NPD.
And who actually is participating on the standing committee?
You have a deputy from each party. And for the Bloc Québécois, sorry, it's Mr. Loubier. And from the NPD, I don't know in English, it's Pat Martin, and they're the one really rejecting the proposed legislation. And the rest, of course, you will have Alliance Canadienne and Liberal, and also people from Nunavut.
And is it useful to call out to the members of the standing committee to let them know what people think about the First Nations Governance Act?
Every action that the person will do, it's going to help us, for sure. Well, if people want to send letters or use the cabinet fax in Ottawa or, you know, a phone call, on behalf of Quebec Native Women, my biggest dream is that they understand in Ottawa, they understand that the C7 proposed legislation will not repair any form of discrimination against women and their children. So they should say that in their statement if they do an action to help us.
And Denise? Upon hearing this interview and being informed of the issues around the First Nations Governance Act, Michelle is suggesting phone calls And I'm wondering what suggestions do you have for people who have just learned about the First Nations Governance Act, or perhaps they've just gotten the details, because it has reached the mainstream media here and there, but not to any great extent. But what are your suggestions for action that people take now, Denise?
I think I would call upon people, especially because we have a lot of people who have landed in this country and they have no idea that Native people exist. And they always ask for teepees. Do we still live in teepees? I mean, that's still a myth that's around today. I think I really strongly urge them to hurry up and find their heart. And if they can look into their heart and see that there are real people, that there are real lives that are on the line, and they can help save a life, because to me, that's what's going on. I'm not ready to be a museum piece, extinct like the dinosaurs. I am not ready, and I don't think any Native person is. So I think it is to look into their hearts and find their heart quickly so that they can really, truly speak out, whether it's through a letter campaign, whether it's going to visit their MLA or whatever, whether it's to hold sessions, information sessions, to get to know Native people, because we don't bite, but I think the call is out there to now get to know who we are. We're not landed, we've always been here.
I really feel that it's been a wonderful opportunity to have to speak with both of you, because we've sort of began in 1869 and 1874 when the Canadian government was actually taking words and putting them down on paper, describing the relationship that they wanted in law with First Nations people. And now we've come 45 minutes later, an hour later, and we're talking about the kind of relationship that Canadian people need to be establishing with First Nations people. So it seems like the government is, there's some encouragement coming from you, Denise, to just boot the government out of that equation and establish relationships among Canadians and First Nations people, and to just throw all this, the First Nations Governance Act and some of these legislations, and the attempts that they've made over the years through the residential schools, through the membership rules, through implementing band councils, to put that aside and build some concrete relationships.
Yes. Well, these laws and these acts have been put in place for a reason, and they don't just affect Native people. In fact, your laws that affect you also affect us. So in turn, whatever happens to the Native person, look behind, in back of you, because it's going to affect you and bite you in the ass too. And that's, just plain English, of what's going on. And our governments, the governments are not listening to the people. Women are suffering. They're not being looked at. They're not being talked to. The children are suffering.
Well, I think I know what Denise's sign is going to say at the next demonstration, Michelle. I think it's going to be something to the effect of FNGA, bite you in the ass. Well, again, thank you. Thank you both very much. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye, Michelle. Bye, Denise.
Yeah!
Yeah.